Welcome back to the Frozen Frontiers podcast. I'm your hostess, Tracy Wolmer. Have you ever looked at a celebrity who died in the prime of their life and you wonder what they could have accomplished had they only lived to old age? For me, Jedediah Smith is one of those celebrities. This man was one of the biggest contributors to our understanding of the fur trade and possibly of the West in general. He kept meticulous journals, drew exquisitely detailed maps of the wildernesses that he was exploring, as well as the trapping grounds that they covered. And he kept meticulous records of what life was like during his years on the frontier. He was a very pious man, a shrewd businessman, and a brave leader and protector of his men. He kind of set the bar for a lot of the younger trappers that were coming through. So today we're going to take a journey into the action-packed, albeit short, life of Jedediah Strong Smith. Jed was born in Jericho, New York, what we today call Bainbridge, on January 6, 1779. His father, also named Jedediah, and his mother, Sally Strong, were both of Puritan ancestry, and they were devout Methodists, and Jed would carry that faith throughout his life. Jed Sr. and his brother-in-law, Cyrus Strong, ran a general store of sorts in Jericho, New York. But as the population increased, Jed Sr. began yearning for wilder frontiers, moving his wife and his 14 children again and again to stay on the outskirts of civilization. By 1810, the family eventually landed in Erie County, Pennsylvania. Some sources say this continual moving was because of a legal issue Jed Sr. was having involving some counterfeit currency, while others say it was just his desire to appreciate the solitude of the frontier. Either way, this upbringing of constantly seeing new frontiers would equate to a wanderlust in the younger Jedediah, who up to now had been considering a life in the ministry. As a child, he met Dr. Titus Gordon Vespasian Simons, and Dr. Simons found Jed Jr. to be extremely bright and eager to learn. So he tutored the boy in all of the education that would help him in a minister's life, reading and writing and figuring, which is what we today call math, and he even taught him Latin. Now, at the tender age of 13, young Jed Smith would take a job as a clerk on a Lake Erie freighter. And Dr. Simons had taught him well. It was here that he would apply those math skills while he learned the ins and outs of running a business. He would also get to meet rugged fur traders from Canada, and he likely heard grand stories of untamed, beautiful frontiers. He would get his first taste of the fur trade here, and he'd learn all of the logistics that went with it. Now, it's said that in 1814, when he was only 15 years old, Dr. Simons gave Jed a copy of Lewis and Clark's recently released book about their 1804-1806 expedition to the Pacific. And I wonder if Dr. Simons had any idea of the impact that book would have, not only on this teenager, but our country as well. It's said by some that this is the pivotal point where Jed decided against the ministry and instead chose to blaze new trails across the continent. It's also said that to his dying day, Jed Smith carried that book with him everywhere he went. So the Smith family relocates once more, this time landing in Green Township, Ohio, in what we today would call Ashland County. By the year 1822, Jed is in St. Louis, Missouri, looking for work. He's now 23 years old, and he's strong, and he's a strapping 6 foot tall. And he answers an ad posted by William Henry Ashley looking for 100 strong men to work up the Missouri River. Jed was hired immediately, as soon as Ashley saw the kid, and he served the role of a hunter and a trapper. Now, he joins up with other young bucks his age, including David E. Jackson, Jim Bridger, Thomas Fitzpatrick, and a man named Mike Fink, all of whom we will hear about in other episodes. So the whole group of them are sent up the Missouri River on a keelboat. For those new to river navigation, a keelboat is a large flat-bottom boat that has a rigid keel running the full length of the boat. It has a little cabin-like structure in the center, and that covers the cargo and the crew. If you've ever seen the movie The Revenant, or even the official trailer for the movie, that's the big wooden boat that they're trying to get to during the Arikara attack, and later they're shown poling it down the river. Now, Jed is with all these other new recruits being instructed by the older, more experienced trappers, people like Hugh Glass. And they're making their way up the Missouri River. About 3 weeks into the trip, the keelboat that he's on, it's named the Enterprise, and it sinks. And the men are forced to wait for weeks at the site until word makes it back to Ashley to send up another boat. Once it arrives, they continue upriver, and this is Jed's first real glimpse of the wilderness. By October of 1822, the whole crew has now reached Fort Henry at the mouth of the Yellowstone River, and they continue up the Missouri a bit more and make their winter camp. Jed is immediately sent back down to Missouri to get word to Ashley that they need more horses. So his message is to purchase them from the local Arikara tribe. Okay, at this point, there's something you need to know about the Arikara Indians, particularly if you've watched the movie The Revenant and you see how hostile they are. They weren't really hostile with the whites up to this point, but they weren't friendly either. They were businessmen. They had up to now acted as the middleman in the fur trade by purchasing pelts from the tribes farther afield and trading them to the whites for the trade goods, and they had done remarkably well at it. But they were getting upset over a number of things happening. First of all, there was this smallpox epidemic that nearly decimated their people between the years of 1780 and 1782. And with this white man came the white diseases that they had no natural immunity to, and they were upset. Secondly, there were white trading posts going up all over the place, in the lands of the Sioux, in the lands of the Crow and the Cheyenne, but not in their lands. They wanted a trading post of their own, so they had access to the same goods their neighbors were buying. William Henry Ashley was supposed to have built one, but he didn't want to waste time setting up a permanent fort when he was trying to get out past the Missouri, so he offered to have the goods shipped. But those goods never arrived, and the Arikara saw this as yet another one of the white man's broken promises. They also weren't happy that men like Ashley were sending out white trappers to get the beaver pelts directly out of the field, rather than buying the pelts from the tribe. That trading was their lifeblood, and without it, their existence would be in danger, and they were scared. Now, another point of contention was the friendship that the U.S. government enjoyed with the Sioux. The Arikara, or the Rees, as you might read in the trappers' personal journals, believed that the Sioux were bullies. They were always bossing around other tribes and taking whatever they wanted, and the Rees and the Sioux became bitter rivals. Since the white man was friends with the Sioux, well, he must be against the Rees as well. Besides all of that, they were harboring a 17-year-old grudge. Their chief had taken a trip to the U.S. Capitol in 1806, and he died on the trip. Now, he did die of natural causes, but they were convinced that the white government had murdered him. So they were already salty by the time they get into an argument with some trappers from the Missouri Fur Company. Between the 1800s and 1823, skirmishes and raids were becoming more and more frequent. The relations with this tribe were essentially a powder keg, and this tiff with the Missouri Fur Company lit the fuse. By the spring of 1823, Jed and a new group of recruits are in the Arikara camp. They're trying to negotiate the purchase of several horses and buffalo robes. After weather delays and multiple frustrations on both sides, an argument breaks out, and the trappers withdraw back to their group empty-handed. Well, the Arikara hit the warpath. First, they attacked Fort Recovery, which is owned by the Missouri Fur Company, and they killed two of the traders there. Then a few days later, on June 2, 1823, the Arikara attacked the Ashley's Hundreds trappers while they were working on their lines. 12 men were killed outright, and 3 others were mortally wounded. And this is the scene that's portrayed in the movie The Revenant, where the Indians are attacking the men as they're trying to get to the boat. That's the Arikara Indians. Jed Smith and David Jackson fought bravely to protect the horses that were picketed in camp. When most of the horses lay dead at their feet, Jed and Jackson fought their way to the shoreline and leapt into the river, and they swam after the keelboat as it's pulling away through this hailstorm of arrows. So the trappers pulled their way downstream where they were hunkered down while a runner was sent back to Ashley for reinforcements. A volunteer was also needed to take word north to Andrew Henry, who was waiting 1,000 miles upstream. And Jed's the one who volunteered. So a French-Canadian hunter also volunteered to accompany him. And these two men made that trip nearly 1,000 miles through unfamiliar territory, swarming with dangerous animals and hostile natives, and utterly exposed to the environment. They eventually found Andrew Henry on the Yellowstone River, and they gave their account of what happened. But then they turned right around and went back down the Missouri River to their comrade's aid. After having had to travel back through this Arikara territory, he finds his fellow trappers sheltered close to the river. And for several weeks, they stayed hunkered down there until the 6th Infantry, under the leadership of Colonel Henry Leavenworth, arrived. During this time, they buried their dead, and Jed gave a prayer over the graves. In a letter to one of the families of the slain, a young trapper named John, Hugh Glass wrote, "Mr. Smith, a young man from our company, made a powerful prayer, who moved us all greatly, and I am persuaded John died in peace. His body we buried with the others near this camp, and marked the grave with a log. His things will be sent to you." So 230 soldiers, 750 Sioux, and 50 other trappers came to their aid. While the government pursued the errant natives, Jed Smith was sent with the fur bundles to get them safely back to Ashley in St. Louis. By the time Jed and Ashley returns to the group, peace has been brokered by Leavenworth, and the group now reassembles to continue to the planned winter camp with the friendly Crow tribe at the mouth of the Bighorn River. So in 1823, Ashley promoted Jed to the rank of captain and put him in charge of his own company of men, with Thomas Fitzpatrick named as his right-hand man. For the rest of 1823, Captain Smith and his company of 16 men traveled downriver from Fort Henry to Fort Kiowa, between present-day Chamberlain, South Dakota, and the Big Bend of the Missouri River. His group left there and explored the southern Black Hills of South Dakota and Wyoming, being the first white men to do so. Their intention was to gradually work their way to the Rocky Mountains, but fate would intervene. Somewhere along the Cheyenne River, near Buffalo Gap and Beaver Creek today, in the southwestern corner of South Dakota, Smith was exploring well ahead of his party when a grizzly bear exploded from the thicket. Jed was knocked violently to the ground, ribs smashing deep in his chest. An explosion of light filled his eyes as the grizzly's teeth sunk into the sides of his head. The bear slammed his massive paw down on the man's chest, the broken ribs straining under the weight of this beast. With a great yank, the bear pulled at the man's head, severing the scalp and ear from the skull. The nerve endings tore away, sending a shock of pain from the soles of his feet to the top of Jed's head, as the scalp was jerked free. A bloody mass hung from the man's left ear as the blood poured down Jed's face. Jed lay on the ground in the leaf litter, blood flowing freely over his hands as he's holding his mangled scalp together. Time must have crawled by as Jed lay motionless, his head pounding, waiting for the grizzly to wander away into the thick undergrowth. Blood oozed from the wound as he held his damaged scalp against his skull. Praying the rest of his party came before his demise, he recited the 23rd Psalm to himself. His faith gave him comfort and the strength to keep his wits about him. When a young trapper named Jim Kleinman arrived on the scene, he was horrified. Jed Smith very coolly explained that Jim had to sew this hanging flesh back on. Now, being new to the fur trade, Jim was young and he thought he'd seen it all, and he wasn't thrilled at the prospect of sewing his boss back together. But Jed calmly talked him through it, and in Kleinman's own journal, Jim wrote, "I put my needle, sticking it through and through, and over, laying the lacerated parts together as nice as I could with my hands." Now, the scarring was extensive. And from that day forward, Jed wore his hair long on that side to cover the reminder of this bear attack. Here's a side note, though. I read several accounts saying that Jim Clyman was so nervous he accidentally sewed Jed's right ear on backwards. I can't find any proof of this in the journals, and I think Jed would have made mention of this. Now, while Jed spent the next 10 days waiting for his broken ribs to mend and his scalp to stop throbbing, his men explored the Black Hills. On the 11th day, the amazing Jed Smith led his men out of the Black Hills and took off towards the Rocky Mountains. 11 days after this massive bear attack severed his scalp. So the winter of 1823, and most of 1824, was consumed by the exploration of the South Pass and the Green River Basin and the Columbia River Basin, where he met other trappers like Alexander Ross. And then they continued to explore around Cache Valley in what we today call Utah. By the following year, Ashley's partner, Andrew Henry, wanted to retire, so Jed Smith bought out Henry's half of the company. And the firm was renamed Ashley and Smith. And Jed had gone from a new recruit to a full-fledged partner in just over a year. Another interesting event that happened in 1824 was a chance encounter with a band of Iroquois who were taking their furs to the nearest Hudson's Bay trading post. Well, Jed convinced them that they'd get more money for their furs by selling to the Americans, and he paid them very handsomely for those pelts. But he stole the sales right out from underneath the Hudson's Bay Company. Shortly after, he ran into a group of trappers led by Peter Ogden, who worked for Hudson's Bay Company, and he acted like nothing happened, proving that not only is this guy tough as nails, but he's shrewd when it comes to business. In the spring of 1825, his crew began to make their way towards the rendezvous point near the Green River. On his way there, he was met by 23 trappers who had just deserted Peter Ogden's group and asked if he could join up with the Americans. Well, Jed took them into his company as free trappers, and they continue on to the rendezvous. Ashley arrived at the 1825 rendezvous site near Henry's Fork River on July 2nd. This is the first time that the trade goods met the trappers in the mountain, and it was very warmly received. Supplies had run out weeks before, and the trappers celebrated the arrival of the mule trains with gusto. After a brisk single day of trading, with all of the supplies being sold out in one day, and all the furs now packed back on those empty mules, Ashley returned to St. Louis with Jed Smith and David Jackson by his side. It's assumed that the conversation during that three-month journey back to St. Louis must have revolved around the topic of Ashley being tired of all this and wanting to retire. So it was agreed that Jed Smith, David E. Jackson, and another man named William Sublette would take over the partnership. A quick explanation about how this business ownership worked. A company like Smith, Jackson, and Sublette would have had a contract stating they deal exclusively with Ashley for their trade goods. But instead of Ashley delivering those goods to the rendezvous point, the new partnership would have to travel back to St. Louis to get them. And that task fell on William Sublette, who spent almost 8 months out of the year just ferrying supplies and furs back and forth to the far reaches of the wilderness. David Jackson was the guy in charge, or the bourgeois, in the mountains, so he had to be in the field, so to speak, and that's actually why we know so little about him. He rarely came out of the mountains. But another aspect of the fur trade is opening up new opportunities, and that can only be done by exploring new territory. Just because an area is untouched by humans doesn't mean it's naturally full of fat beavers. It might actually be barren of wildlife, like a desert would. So fur traders would have exploratory groups that went out to map out the best trapping grounds. With their explorations opening new grounds between them and the California ports to the west, the partners felt it might be in their best interest to ship furs from the west coast rather than pack mule it all back over the Rocky Mountains and across the middle of the wilderness. Now, for the record, they weren't the first ones to think of this. John Jacob Astor had started this concept when he established the Pacific Fur Company way back in 1810. And the Russian-American fur company was doing it from 1700s. So it's not the first ones to think of it, but it's a good idea. There are also deals to be made to replenish horses and to acquire new buffalo hides for winter camps. There are treaties and agreements to forge with native tribes that would allow the trappers to hunt unmolested on native lands. And like any business, there are other logistics to consider. There's elbows to rub and networks to polish. I can only imagine how happy Jed Smith was that this task fell to him. And we are so lucky that it did. Of the three partners, he was the one with the best education. He was very articulate and very skilled in all manners of business. And boy, could that man write a journal. In the spring of 1826, Jed Smith left Missouri and he began a journey that would make him the first white man from the Mississippi to the Pacific over the Midland Route. Using his beloved Lewis and Clark 1804-1806 expedition book and utilizing all the discoveries that they had made during his time with Ashley's Hundred, he would chronicle this journey in a series of journals, giving us a ridiculous amount of insight into the world of 1826. Now, I will post a link to Jed Smith's journals of his travels, but I want to give you a fair warning. The way that the journals were documented is like one large paragraph of continual text. So, his party of 18 men is actually listed out by name in the 1826 journal, including what country they hailed from. And it's because of this that we know that three of them were Indian slaves, one was a Mexican native, seven were Americans, two were from Ireland, two or possibly three were from Scotland, and one was a German. Who would have thought there would have been so much diversity on this trapping frontier? We also know from these journals that on his first expedition to the wild California territory, he actually brokered a peace agreement between the Snake and the Ute nations. We also know that he discovered a band of Timpanogos Indians. They're a sub-band of the Shoshone, which very little was understood about. In his journal, he tells us how they dressed, how they lived, what they ate. And this emphasizes the value of the journals from trappers like Jed Smith. In some cases, their accounts are the only details we have about a people who are gone forever. He also depicts the conditions that he and his traveling companions suffered and the hunger they faced in the areas where food was scarce. Horses wear out and break down, leaving them to walk across parts of the vast North American continent. He writes of coming upon a farmhouse where an old Indian lived and how his trials up to this point had taught him to keep a horse bridled and waiting at the door in case he needed to get himself out of harm's way in a hurry. And he wrote about visiting the Catholic missions and how kindly he was received, despite the fact that he was a Protestant. I could do 12 episodes on these journals alone, so I'll just summarize it as we go. But I strongly encourage you to check out the link and read through some of the things that this man faced in his short life. Now, there was a legend back in these days of a massive water course called the Buenaventura River. And that ran, supposedly, from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean through what we now would call the Western United States. And many an explorer spent their whole lives trying to find it, hopeful that it would become the artery to the Rocky Mountains, just like the Missouri became for the Central States. So while Jed and his crew are meandering around the mountains, he's always got one eye on the lookout for this mythical river. And much of the year of 1826 was Jed and his group searching deep into Mexico territory for this Buenaventura River. They headed south through present-day Utah into what we now call Nevada. The conditions were ridiculously harsh, and travel was really slow and difficult. And his journals tell of the lack of water, and how they had to dig holes 2 and 3 feet deep to get even moderately brackish drinking water. The salt plains also did a number on their horses as well, causing the animals to go lame faster than normal. He eventually came to a river and he followed it into the Mojave Desert area. And he writes of the lifestyles of another tribe, known as the Vanaume Indians, that treated him very well. Now, something I found remarkable, and I think it speaks volumes about what kind of a person Jedediah Smith was, is in his journal, where he's just depicted days of little drinking water and no food at all. And they're starving, and they're dehydrating. And he spies a herd of several hundred buffalo and kills one of them to feed his men. Then he realizes that it had a brand on the hip, showing that it was owned by one of the local tribes. So he has the beast skinned so he could find out who it belongs to so that he can pay the man for the animal. This is why many historians say that Jed Smith set the bar for other mountain men to follow. He was a man of faith, integrity, and honesty, which blows the stereotype of the unpolished, uneducated, wild-haired mountain man right out of the water. So this group has traveled into the Southwest, following the Colorado River and into the Mojave Valley. Here they're told that the Mexican settlements in California are only 10 days away. So in late October 1826, they set off across the Mojave Desert in hopes that they would be able to resupply once they get to those Mexican settlements in California. Well, the journal took 16 brutal days of life-sapping heat and horrific travel conditions. Nearly out of food, they stagger out of the desert and into the lush San Bernardino Valley about mid-November. Their horses are emaciated and they're dropping like flies, and the men themselves are ragged and gaunt. But they accomplished something incredible. They traveled 1,300 miles through the bowels of Hades without losing a single man. However, their victory would be short-lived because now they were trespassing in Mexican territory. So they arrive at the San Gabriel Mission, and they're decently received and they're restocked. And while they're waiting for their supplies to be loaded, Jed receives a summons to come meet the governor of the territory in San Diego. The governor believed Jed and his party to be spies, and when Jed shows up for this meeting, he's arrested and he's imprisoned until his fate is decided. Eventually, the governor released Captain Smith and his men, and he gave them the supplies they needed, and he ordered them to leave immediately, going back the exact way they had just arrived. Well, not wanting to run the gauntlet through the Mojave Desert again, Jed instead led his men back into the San Bernardino Mountains and ran a trail north along the range, heading back in the general direction of the rendezvous location in Utah. Trapping as they went, they accumulated 1,500 pounds of beaver pelts by the time they reached the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Well, the first attempt to get across the mountains was a complete disaster. 8 feet of snow lay on the ground, and it was continuing to fall at an alarming rate. Deciding that the best course of action was not to risk the entire company, Jed instructed the brigade to set up a winter camp while he himself crossed the Sierra Nevadas with only 2 men, 7 horses and 2 mules. He was able to do it in a week's time, which in itself is remarkable. But now he has to cross the Great Basin. For anyone not familiar, the Great Basin basically overlaps 4 different deserts. Some are hot, like you would commonly think when you hear the word desert, with sand dunes and cacti. But some are cold deserts, receiving copious amounts of snow and suffering extremely cold temperatures. Now Jed and his 2 guys have to travel through all 4 of these to get to the rendezvous site in Utah. During that time, they were snowbound in a storm that raged for days. His journal says that on May 26, 1827, 2 horses and 1 mule froze to death standing right next to his men. The snow was 4 to 8 feet deep at all times, and both the men and the horses sunk up to a foot into the snow with every step. After 2 days of struggling through this, his men and his horses were so exhausted, so he gave them the day of rest. They had no shelter, so they laid down in the snow, trying to re-energize their depleted bodies. And a tribe of unnamed Indians comes by and sees them and starts pelting them with rocks, trying to scare them away. but the exhausted men were so tired they couldn't move. They just laid there and got pelted. By the next morning, they had recuperated enough to continue. Now, days later, the horses again begin to suffer from the rough ground and they're starting to give out. And with each horse that faltered, he set it free to live out the last of its life unburdened. A week after that, he states that they're on a food ration of 4 ounces of dried meat a day, and very little water is to be found. Just days later, those rations ran out, and he was forced to kill the lamest horse to sustain his men. As this journey continues, the weakest animals are giving sustenance for a month-long journey across this desert to the rendezvous. By the time they made it back to Salt Lake area, they had one horse and one mule left, and both were so fragile they could barely carry the equipment that he had. The three men arrive at the rendezvous site days late, looking like skeletons. A company of camping trappers had written Smith and his party off as dead. So to see this emaciated man stagger into camp, it must have been a sight. There was great excitement and celebrations, and the men even fired off a 4-pound cannon that Ashley was sending to one of the local forts. And only 10 days later, Jed and a very well-supplied party of 18 men were back on the road going to retrieve the men that he left in the San Bernardino Mountains. Now, something else that tells us what kind of man Jed was is how he regarded the natives. Many times, the indigenous people would run away screaming when the white parties came through, or they'd pelt them with rocks or shout at them and try and scare them off. And even in his direst of times, Jed Smith always traded or presented some token of friendship, even if it was just a little thing, so that he'd have a friend in that neighborhood when he came back around again. And it's because of this that many of the tribes did become friendly to the trappers. However, on the journey back to retrieve the rest of his men, he found that a group of whites had traveled through and they left a trail of destruction in their path. We never find out who these hostile white men were, but Jed reports villages that were burned to the ground, and once friendly Mojave tribes now fearful and aggressive at his approach. All of his productive networking was now for nothing. So, fearing retaliation from the acts of these other parties, Jed pressed his men hard. At one point, they were preparing rafts to cross the Colorado when his men suddenly find themselves surrounded by Mojave Indians. About half of the men are rushing out to swim their rafts across the river when the Mojaves start to get loud and belligerent. Thinking quick, Jed takes all the trade goods and the provisions and he dumps them in a big pile on the ground. As the natives begin fighting over the division of the spoils, his men are trying to slink off into the river to get to safety. Well, the Mojave see them disappearing and they raised a war cry, and they begin to bludgeon the remaining men to death with clubs and rocks. As the survivors rushed into the water, the natives begin a pursuit. Half a mile later, Jed and his men are again surrounded, and they have nothing left to distract the natives with. They had to make a stand. They used their knives and whacked down some small trees to create a bulwark to hide behind. And they lashed their knives to strong branches, trying to make spears. 8 men remained, only 5 of which had rifles, standing against 400 to 500 irate natives. So the Mojave start forming this unending wall around their small brush fortress, and they're hollering and they're yelling. Jed gives his men directions to shoot no more than 3 guns at a time, while the other 2 reload, and to conserve ammo as much as possible. He points out 3 natives to take out first, and the first 3 rifles are fired, and 2 Mojave drop dead instantly, while the 3rd crumbles to the ground mortally wounded. The Mojave are terrified. They fall back and they begin to disperse, and before long, they're gone. Now, Jed's fearing that these hostiles may make a reappearance, so he orders his 8 men to slip out under the cover of darkness. Before long, they were well into the Mojave Desert, their supplies were minimal, and they spent a tense, sleepless night trying to escape. So the sun comes up, and now the heat during the day is starting to sap what little energy they have left. To conserve his men, he rested them by a freshwater spring that he found during the heat of the day, and then he traveled at night in the cooler air. And while this is survival 101 for traveling in the desert, the downside to traveling at night is that the landscape looks entirely different, and common landmarks can be missed. Jed ended up disoriented, and he missed the trail by 5 miles. He eventually had to climb a good-sized hill and get his bearings back again. But he was soon back on track, and he continued traveling at night, resting during the day. And for the next 2 weeks, with his horses and his supplies slowly depleting, he's making good time. Eventually, he reconnected with his men in the San Bernardino Mountains, and surprisingly found them all in good health. He gives them new orders and sets them to work, telling them where to trap, and he sends his men out. He takes 3 with him, and he goes back to the mission to see if he can partake of their hospitality once more. But they're very standoffish. They don't want to see him. They don't want to talk to him. Again, he's promptly arrested, and he's stuck into limbo while the governor decides his fate. While he's imprisoned, he hears of an American at the mission, a guy by the name of William Welch. So he sends word to Welch that he needs help, and Welch does intervene on his behalf. But really, there wasn't actually much that Welch could do for the men other than vouch for them. Jed Smith is tried as an intruder. The judge, however, couldn't find any evidence against him, and Jed finally had the opportunity to request a meeting with the governor in Monterey. So for the next 2 weeks, Jed is sitting at the mission waiting for an answer. Finally, the answer comes and Jed is granted an audience with the governor. It takes 3 days to get the meeting going, and when he finally does get there, the governor is less than eager to deal with these white men. Jed finally gets permission to get on a boat, sail himself and his 3 associates up to the port of San Francisco, where the rest of his men are waiting buying supplies, and then head out of Mexican territory. The governor grants him permission and says, don't ever come back. Now, he had been waylaid for 3 months while all that drama played out. And one of the most interesting things I found in his journal about that trip is, first of all, he got very seasick on the way up to San Francisco. And secondly, he was very upset because the native Mexican Indians were being arrested and tried on the charge of leading him into the territory. One man was found guilty and sentenced to death, while his life was really only spared through a pardon that was requested by one of the friars at the mission. While the man was eventually set free, it really bothered Smith that the natives were being influenced by the Mexican government to be hostile to the whites. So after being granted permission to leave, Jed's handed his passport back and they said, don't come back. Now his party began making the preparations for all the supplies they would need to head north. Dried meat, water containers, packing up the furs. And fearing that the party wouldn't make it following those same treacherous Great Basin route that he had to take the previous year, he decides to lead his men north along the coast of Northern California. By mid-July 1828, the group has reached the Umpqua River, and they're establishing a camp. Local Queech Indians, they're sometimes called the Lower Umpqua people, came to trade, and while they seemed friendly enough, Jed had a nagging feeling something wasn't right. But the natives departed without incident, and Jed got back to business. On July 14th, 1828, while Jed and 2 men were out scouting a river crossing, leaving 16 men in camp to clean their rifles and clean their gear, 100 of those Cooch came back to trade, and something terrible happened. There are 2 common theories in all of the resources that I've read about what happened next. One theory is that one of Smith's men made an inappropriate advance towards one of the Umpqua women. Another theory is that one of the Umpqua boys stole a hand axe from the camp, and in trying to recover it, the trapper accidentally shot the boy and he was killed. Or maybe intentionally. What is certain is the result. A massacre of 15 of 16 men left in Jed's camp who were bludgeoned to death for whatever transgression had happened. Fleeing for their lives, the three men, Jed and his two companions, bolted into a canoe, and they paddled like madmen to Fort Vancouver, which is a supply station owned by Hudson's Bay Company. The only survivor of the massacre stumbled into the fort around the same time. And something we need to look at here is the relationship between Hudson's Bay Company and the American trappers. Hudson's Bay Company was essentially fighting an economic war against the Americans. Trappers on both sides were trying to shoot each other, sabotaging traps and stealing pelts from each other, and in some cases, they were waging ecological warfare against their opponents by decimating beaver populations just so the other side couldn't have any. It was brutal, dirty, nasty business politics. But when one human being, no matter what company he worked for, was in distress, they all looked out for each other. So Hudson's Bay Company sends a brigade to accompany Captain Smith and his surviving men back to the camp. They're able to recover 30-some horses, most of the furs and the gear, and probably most importantly for us, all of the journals and books of Jed Smith and his clerk. They buried the 11 bodies they found, though four remained unaccounted for. Jed and his men returned to Fort Vancouver, where they were hosted quite comfortably by the British, who even purchased his horses and furs. And they spent the rest of the winter in relative comfort with their hosts. In trade, Jed copied all of his maps and notes for the people in Fort Vancouver. So with the spring thaw in 1829, Jed Smith made his way back to the Rocky Mountains, and he meets up with David Jackson at Flathead Lake. From there, the two men and their companions turn south, eventually meeting the third partner of William Sublette at the rendezvous at Pierre's Hole. If you listen to the rendezvous episode, part 2, you'll remember that 1829 was the only year there were two rendezvous. The first one was near Lander, Wyoming, and the second one was at Pierre's Hole, where the whole camp celebrated the second reappearance of Jedediah Smith, because they believed him to have been killed in the Umpqua attack. In 1829, Smith then organizes a fur trade expedition into the heart of Blackfoot territory. Now, the Blackfoot are a tribe who are openly hostile to American trappers up to this point. And he somehow manages to sneak in, acquire several thousand dollars worth of furs before the Blackfeet chased him back out again. In fact, Jim Bridger is said to have been his riverboat pilot for that crazy expedition. Perhaps because of the stress of it all, or the desire to do something new, Smith, Jackson, and Sublette dissolved their business in 1830, selling the assets to Sublette's younger brother Milton, Thomas Fitzpatrick, Jim Bridger, Henry Frabe, and John Gervais, who then renamed the company the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. Now, during all this time, the three men have made a substantial profit, and Jed Smith is considerably wealthy by the day's standards. When he receives word that his mother had passed away in 1830, he sends a considerable sum of money back to serve as a pension for his dad. And he even sends his siblings, remember there's 14 of them, he sends them each money to buy a home. Then he buys himself a house in St. Louis that he goes on to share with his two brothers. And he retires to a quiet life, copying his journals and his maps to get them ready for publication. But as the saying goes, you can take the man out of the mountain. And Jed Smith teamed up again with his old friends for one more run, this time through the largely explored territory surrounding the Santa Fe Trail. With him were William Sublette, David Jackson, and Thomas Fitzpatrick, all men who had spent their whole lives wandering the untamed wilderness with Jed Smith. Now, the four men broke camp with their supply wagons near the Arkansas River on May 25th of 1831. And on the morning of May 27th, 3 days later, the wagon train entered the arid region between the Arkansas River and the Cimarron River. This is well explored and well-traveled territory, but it's also very arid, and the men knew they were going to have to ration their water to get through it unscathed. So Jed and Thomas Fitzpatrick left ahead of the wagon train, and they began exploring the trail ahead, just like they do every time, scouting out a suitable site for the wagon train to camp. The two men split up, and Jed continued to scout out a source of fresh water as Thomas went back to escort the wagon train in. It was the last time any of those men would see their friend alive. Coming to the Cimarron River, Jed found the river to be dried, except for the glistening sand. Years of experience had taught him that where the ground is wet, one could dig down a few feet and find potable water. Jed dismounted and began to dig. Water began to seep into the hole. He laid down on his stomach and he began to drink the water that was pooling before him, testing to see if it was fresh enough for his party to drink. While he lay down at the edge of that small pool of water, a warband of Comanche attacked, striking his exposed back with arrows. Springing to his feet, he leveled his rifle at the chief, and he felled the rampaging man in a single blow. Arrows struck his body again and again, and the warriors unleashed hell upon him. Yet he fought on until his last breath. The only witnesses to the event were the Comanche, who later told others that even mortally wounded and nearing death, Jed took out two of their war party plus their chief. On May 27, 1831, his remains lay somewhere in this arid landscape to feed the scavenging coyotes and to leave his sun-bleached bones for the mice to gnaw. Now, several theories exist as to the whereabouts of his remains. One story is that Jed had been wearing a U.S. Army jacket when he was killed instead of his normal buckskin jacket, and that the natives killed him thinking he was a military officer. It also proposed that had he been in his buckskin jacket, they'd likely have passed him by. In the 1930s, a group of boys from Kansas were camping on the Cimarron River, and they found a rock outcropping with a pack rat den inside. Hoping to find cool souvenirs that the pack rats drug in, they began removing that nest. And under the pack rat den, they discovered two skeletons. One an Indian with many beads around his neck, and the other a white man with U.S. Army buttons. Since there is no other record of men killed in this area, it's assumed to be the bones of Jed Smith. There are a few problems with this theory, though. If the buried Indian was, in fact, a chief, he'd likely have been taken back home for a proper burial. The Comanche were known to wrap a body in a blanket and carry it off to a secure burial location, like a cave, or a rocky outcrop near their home. While it's possible that they buried their chief under this outcrop, there were also supposed to be two other men killed. Where were their bodies? Would they really take two warriors home but leave the chief? It's unlikely. Even if one of those skeletons was the warrior and not a chief, there's nothing to say that that white man was Jed Smith. Also, the bones were lost to time afterwards, and the possibility of DNA testing is now gone forever. The only evidence, in quotes, is the story told by these children. Another theory is that Jed and his party were lost, and they were wandering around for 4 days before Jed discovered the dry creek bed. Okay, we are talking about four of the best fur trappers and explorers in the history of man, who are in an area that is well explored, and that some of them have already traveled once. Getting lost? I don't think so. This is the same Jed Smith that trekked through the Mojave Desert at night without getting lost. And maps of this area were available. We know that Jed had one in his possession when he was killed, Thomas Fitzpatrick told us. I find the theory hard to believe, considering just who we're talking about. Another theory is that Jed and the party went into the desert ill-prepared. Again, we're talking about four men who are the foremost experts on being prepared for wilderness survival. They've been eating, sleeping, and breathing wilderness prep for 12 years. I'd be willing to bet that every container they had, every barrel, every water skin, was filled to the brim with water before that train took off. And considering the lessons learned on Jed's last two trips through a desert with minimal water, I'm pretty sure he himself would have been well stocked before he hit the trail. This is also a trail that Thomas Fitzpatrick has already traversed once, so you can't convince me that they were lost or ill-prepared. He was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Either way, not knowing what became of their companion, the rest of the train continued on to Santa Fe. And weeks later, a Comanche war party arrives, and one of them is wearing Jed's gear. And it was only then that the friends began to piece together what happened. His tales and his triumphs would likely have been lost to history if it weren't for the fact that he had copied his journals and maps, and everything was sitting back at his St. Louis home. And thankfully, Jed's story was not lost to time. In fact, in 1957, a California nonprofit organization named the Jedediah Smith Society was born, with the goal of preserving his legacy for future generations. Now, they hold two annual meetings for their members, one in April at the California History Institute, and the second is later in the year. This event is a rendezvous held at one of Jedediah Smith's known camping sites. What an amazing tribute to a man whose short life contributed so much to our understanding of the wild frontiers of this fledgling nation. So that's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed exploring the life of Jedediah Smith. I encourage you to check out the website at fursandfrontiers.com for links to Jed's journals and other resources. Join me again in a few weeks to see what other North American fur trade history we can delve into. Have a great weekend, everybody, and keep your powder dry.